So I was born in 1936 in India, and then I became a monk, a Jain monk, at the age of 9, and remained in the Jain monastery, monastic life, for 9 years. At the age of 18, I left the monastery and joined the Gandhian movement, the movement which was started by Mahatma Gandhi and carried on by his disciples to bring reform of land and cottage industries and traditional science, traditional crafts, and so on. So I worked in that movement. And then at the age of 26, I went around the world walking for peace. And that took 2.5 years and about 15,000 kilometers. And then I started London School of Nonviolence in London in 1968. And that kept going for 9 or 10 years. That was to train young people into the technique of nonviolent resistance on the principle of Mahatma Gandhi.
Among his countless other involvements, Satish Kumar is the editor of Resurgence magazine, a journal of ecology, the environment, new economics, new education, green politics, and holistic thinking. How did Resurgence come into being, and how did you become associated with it?
In the 60s, when the peace movement was quite strong in England, a group of people felt that peace is not something you can negotiate or declare and get through the agreement of superpowers. Peace is a natural byproduct of a kind of society which is in harmony with itself and with nature. And therefore, we have to take the issue of peace in a much broader sense. And since the 60s was the age or the decade of flower power and spiritual surge and values, so a group of people got together and started this magazine. I was one of them in the beginning, but I was not the editor. The editor was John Papworth, and people like E.F. Schumacher, he wrote regularly, and Leopold Kohr, who wrote regularly. And so many ideas of small is beautiful, ecological lifestyle, new economics, were written first in Resurgence in the 60s. So that's how the magazine was started.
And how did you get associated with it?
The president of Zambia, President Kaunda, asked John Papworth, who was the editor at that time, to come to Zambia to help him with some work and advise him on various aspects of his work. So he left for Zambia, and they were looking for an editor. So at that time, that was in the early 70s, I was sort of asked by John and E.F. Schumacher and Leopold Kohr and various people who were involved whether I will take up the editorship. And I liked the idea because I always have been a sort of enthusiastic supporter and contributor to Resurgence. And I felt that the 70s and the 80s are going to be very, very important in changing the attitudes and the values of our society and of people. And therefore, my contribution through Resurgence will be important. At that time, when I became editor, Resurgence was going sort of downhill. We had only 500 subscribers, so the magazine was very small. So I took up the challenge, And ever since the early 70s, we have been building up the magazine on a small scale, but slowly. And now we have 10,000 subscribers. So magazine has grown. We don't want to go on a mass circulation scale. We don't want to be sold at big trade outlets like W.H. Smith and other news agents, because we think that the spirit of the magazine will be lost if we become a mass circulating magazine. So we want to remain a subscription-based magazine so that we can keep its integrity and its sort of sharpness of message. Because once you have the subscribers, you know how many copies you can print. Whereas going through the trade, you are always at the mercy of the trade and the buyer. And therefore, you are always diluting your message to make it popular so that the magazine will sell and everybody will press it on you that if you don't make this or that compromise, magazine will not sell. So we have avoided going through the trade and mass circulation. And we are happy to keep it small as it is. We don't want... And I think lots of ideas which we have been writing for last 23 years are now becoming much more mainstream. And many newspapers, daily newspapers and weekly newspapers are taking up those issues and writing about them. So I think Resurgence has played its part in changing some of the thinking in England.
As the editor of Resurgence, one of the intentions of your trip to Japan is to do a special issue on the Japanese ecological movement. How would you assess the situation so far, just from what you've seen?
I feel that the environmental movement, ecological movement in Japan is quite small. It seems to me, so far, what I have gathered is quite small. And Japan seems to be making tremendous headway in its technological and scientific success, and people seem to be much more interested in intensifying that success rather than taking a long-term view of the situation and what will be the implication and the effects of this technological success. It seems to me that Japan is going through some kind of economic golden age, and people are so successful in their materialistic and economic pursuits nationally and internationally, and they seem to be rather intoxicated with this success, and therefore they don't seem to have much time for the ideas of green values and new economics and local economics and alternative education and this sort of thing. However, I have met quite a few, although they are in a very small minority, but nevertheless, quite a few people from the organic agriculture movement and from the anti-nuclear power movement, who are very genuine people, very wise sort of people, and have a long-term view. And I feel that they are going to be the salt of the country, and or yeast of the country, and they are going to be the catalyst of change. And therefore, I'm not discouraged or in any way despair. I think the seeds of change are quite strongly alive in Japan.
Well, faced with the size and power of the organizations and the corporations that we are all trying to dismantle, do you think that grassroots movement is really the solution?
Yes, I do, because these big corporations and big governments and big organizations in Japan or in other countries like America and Europe, they are going to run out of steam and they are going to run out of time eventually. They might have another 20 years or 30 years or whatever time it is, but they are going to run out of steam. Then there is going to be some kind of economic crisis and collapse even, because world hasn't got enough resources to offer all the people of the world, including the 8 million Indians and 8 billion Indians and 10 billion Chinese and the rest of Africa and Central America and South America and many other Asian countries, to provide everybody the kind of living standard which Japan and America and Western Europe is enjoying, is going to be impossible because there are not enough resources. So when they start to demand their share of the cake, we will have problems. So people have to rethink. And also, pendulum always swings, and no great empires have lasted forever. The Roman Empire fell, and the British Empire came to an end, and the industrial empire is going to come to an end, because this is not the lasting situation forever. So I feel that at that time, when the crunch comes, it is the grassroots movement, the small movement, who are keeping the alternative way of living alive, the right skills of producing food and building old patterns of houses which do not require a great amount of industrial goods and material, but they can use natural material locally available. Skills of those kinds are going to come back, and we will be needing them. And therefore, I think grassroots movement are very, very important, and we must keep them alive and keep them strong and feed them and nourish them. And there is hope in the grassroots movement.
You have worked in close association with the great economist, Dr. Schumacher, as you mentioned before. How has he influenced you, and in what ways have you put his small is beautiful philosophy into practice?
There are many ideas he had, particularly in two fields. One was very much close to his own work, and that was development of intermediate technology. Because he said that either we have totally primitive technology and therefore work is so slow that peasants and craftsmen can never catch up with any kind of living standard, or on the other hand, you have combined harvesters and robots and automated machinery and so on. So there are two extremes, whereas he wanted to choose the middle way of intermediate technology. So that idea tremendously influenced me. But the other idea, which he did not do himself in practice, but he very much felt for it, and that was in education. He said to me before he died that if I was going to start something now, I would start a small school, because the way we educate our children in large, monolithic, impersonal schools doesn't give any right kind of sense of humanity and personality and values to our children. And therefore, that was almost his last wish, that there should be a small school movement. And therefore, when we were in Heartland, in the village of Heartland where we live, and running Resurgence from there, we thought that we must live our ideas. We must practice what we are preaching. We must experiment with some of the ideas that Schumacher wrote and we are writing in the magazine Resurgence. If ideas are not lived, they become sterile and they become just abstract and intellectual. there is no life, there is no force, there is no sort of dynamic potential in those ideas if they are not brought into life, into reality, into practice. And therefore, we thought that we must start this small school. And so that way, the intermediate technology, which the work of Schumacher himself brought into focus, and the work of human scale education, which we have tried, his kindred spirit friends, I mean, these are the two aspects where human scale and small is beautiful, are being put to test.
Can you talk a little bit about the small school, its basic premises, its goals?
The main concern of the small school movement is that you are teaching children and not subjects. In large schools, you have specialist teachers who teach French, who teach mathematics, who teach science, who teach religion, who teach music, and they are experts in their subjects. What we have sort of changed the focus from the subjects to the children, because by chopping knowledge into the compartments of subjects, you don't get anywhere really. So we want to consider the whole child and develop the intellectual, the academic, the practical, the spiritual, the intuitive aspects of the child. So if you want to develop whole child, you are teaching the child and not the subject. So that is the main premise of our education. Now, if you are interested in teaching the subject, then it doesn't matter who is in the classroom. You are concerned with your book, your information, facts, figures, blackboard. That is your concern, because you are interested in the subject. And then it doesn't perhaps matter if you have a large classroom. But if you are teaching the child, then it becomes paramount that the classroom should be human scale, small scale, so that each child can build a deep and profound trust in the teacher and a personal relationship. And the teacher can do the same with the child, so that the communication is better. Teacher immediately knows when he's teaching or she's teaching whether the child is learning, whether the child is enjoying, whether the child is a bored child or enjoying or not. By looking at the eyes of the child, the face of the child. So you can adapt your education and your teaching to suit the situation and the child. So making the school smaller, community-based, human scale, and personal is most important if you are interested in educating the whole child. Therefore, that is the main premise. And because we are trying to educate the whole child, we are developing lots of practical skills of the children. In our mainstream education, it is very much academic. And if you are not good in intellectual subjects like French or English or maths or science, only then you are given as a sort of chance to try some practical subjects. We are saying that practical subjects are as important as your math, science, and English and French. So we say that for basic living, you need food, you need shelter, you need clothes. Therefore, you need to learn how to grow your food, how to cook your food, how to serve your food, how to build your house, how to make your clothes, how to stitch your clothes, how to... So these are practical things, basket making, woodwork, pottery, cheese making, milking the cow, the goats, basket making, roof making, all these practical skills, we bring quite a lot into our education. And then, of course, we have quite a lot of importance for the values and the spiritual values, and therefore implicit in whole of our education is a system of values, which is based on universal values rather than particular religious values. We are not teaching Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism or any other ism. We are concerned with eternal values. They are like compassion, truth, respect, reverence for life, and so on. So these are the main features of the small school.
As you had mentioned earlier, you had spent 9 years as a Jain monk in India doing meditation, etc. Do you think that by having done that at such an early age, you had a better grasp of the deeper realities of life than the priorities in life? Is this a necessity, do you think, for children of a young age to start their education in a much more meditative, contemplative way?
I was very lucky to have that situation and that possibility that from the age of 9, I could join a monastery in India. In the Western European situation, or in the United States, or in Japan, that kind of situation or possibility is not available to all the children. Therefore, at least what we can do is to reform our schooling system and our educational system in such a way where children can get fundamentals right. And therefore, I would say that starting small school in the way we have done, and the movement for starting many, many small schools all over the country in England and all over the world, I would say, is to me more important because we can't expect all the children of our society to go and start their education in monasteries. But of course, my education as a monk and monastic upbringing did help me to get the fundamentals right and the foundation of my life, in a way, right. Because my attention is much more on the meaning rather than on the form. I'm always, like we are using the language. Language is the form. But the meaning of the language is more my concern. Not how flowery your language is, how wonderful words you can use, what structure of grammar you can make. I'm not so interested. I'm interested in the meaning which we are trying to communicate. That is throughout my education has been in my mind. So always look deeper, the meaning, the soul of things, the spirit of things, the meaning of things. And our education system is much more concerned with the form, how outwardly you can make things. They are impressive, they are attractive, etc. Whether there is a deep meaning in it or not is not concern of the educational system in the mainstream. And that is the shortcoming. Therefore, we have created so many great structures in our society. Buildings, machinery, aeroplanes, airports, nuclear power stations, armaments, nuclear weapons, etc., etc. You can make thousands of items list. But people have lost a sense of meaning. And that is what we need to restore in our education. If we can restore that, we will have, even so small way, we will have achieved something. We can't really expect all children of our society to go and start their lives in a monastery, because that will not be practical. But we can educate children. Sorry.
Can be somehow maybe incorporated into the actual program of the school.
Yes.
You know, starting early morning meditation and doing some yoga, whatever.
Yes, we do that in the small school.
I can see this is the end here, so I will ask you one last question. And so many I want to ask. Let's see which one I'll choose here. Okay, let's make it simple. From where do you derive all of your inspiration?
Ah, that is a very difficult question. You can't really answer that kind of question because it's like asking, define the soul or define the spirit or etc. It is an unknown deep source. You can call it a divine source. we are, all of us, are sort of channel of that source. Everything coming is coming through us. Like Khalil Gibran said, that children come through you, not from you. In the same way, the inspiration, the ideas, the actions, everything what is coming through us is coming through us and not from us. We are not the source. Source is elsewhere. It's eternal source. It's a divine source. It's a sacred source. And I have that feeling of that link with that source. I have a feeling that I am a channel, and it is being expressed through my body or through my actions or through my language or through my being. But it is not something which is in it itself. That great source, the deep source, is a divine source, and which is universal source. It is not something which you can put your finger. You can say, this is the source. You cannot say, my source is Christianity or Hinduism or the Buddha or whatever. Because even those sources are the channels. Even the Buddha and Jesus were the channels. They were not the source. So, source of inspiration was coming from elsewhere, even through them. So, you cannot pinpoint. You cannot really answer that question.